Today is January 24th, 2013. We are in the Hill Library at North Carolina State University. We're going to do a video history for the Simulation Archive. This project is being sponsored by the National Science Foundation. My name is Robert G. Sargent, Syracuse University, and we're here to interview Dr. Richard E. Nance of Virginia Tech. Dick is a leader in the field of simulation, as evidenced by the several awards that he has received. He is perhaps the only person who is fellow both of the Association for Computer Machinery, also known as ACM, and the Institute for Operations Research and Management Sciences, also known as INFORMS. Dick has received service awards from the INFORMS Simulation Society, ACM Sig Sim, Winter Simulation Conference Board of Directors, and the Navy Surface Weapons Center. He has also received the INFORMS Simulation Society Lifetime Professional Achievement Award and the Military Operations Research Society Medal. Of special interest to Dick was the United Kingdom Science Research Council Senior Fellowship he received in 1980. Dick, would you please tell us about this fellowship?
Well, the Science Research Council in the UK is the correspondent to the National Science Foundation in this country. And I had been working in the area of, at the time, simulation models, specification, and documentation languages. Very interested in what was happening in the UK, where they used conceptual models that were called activity cycle diagrams to produce programs in given languages. So I wrote a proposal, as I knew I was coming to a sabbatical year, stepping down as department head in computer science at Virginia Tech, to go study with Stephen Matheson at the Imperial College in the use of the activity cycle diagram and perhaps other graphical mechanisms to support modeling in preparation of the programming task, to some degree automating the programming task. There had been work in this country prior to that, but it had not really caught hold and wasn't really being pursued. I went there and worked at Imperial College for about 4.5 months, with the support money, took a tour of England and even into Scotland, talking with some of the leaders in the field in the UK. Alan Clementson, John Crookes at Lancaster, Alan Clementson was at Birmingham, and I hoped to gain a better understanding of how we would take our work in model specification and move it toward something that I later called the model development environment. And so that's why this was important to me, to have this support to make this survey of procedures that were being used in the UK and widely used.
What led you to the field of simulation?
My advisor in industrial engineering at NC State, where I got my bachelor's and my master's degree, was a Professor Robert G. Llewellyn, who had a strong influence on me. And Llewellyn shared an office with an instructor named H. Allen Knappenberger, who later became head of the Department of Industrial Engineering at Wayne State. In meeting with Llewellyn and discussing the work that we were doing in the classes, Llewellyn taught me some courses, and Alan Knappenberger actually taught me more than anyone else. The term simulation came up, and it came up more than once, so I asked, what is simulation? And they gave me an answer which wasn't exactly understandable at the time. Mr. Knappenberger made it understandable because he has made an assignment where, for the first time, I used Monte Carlo simulation without realizing actually what I was doing to effect a confirmation, if you will, of the central limit theorem in statistics. And I have to say I was fascinated by that, and that was at the undergraduate level. When I returned to graduate school 2 years later, I consulted Lew Ellen, and from there was introduced to discrete event simulation, which I used in my master's work at NC State.
You mentioned you had a two-year period between your bachelor's and master's. What did you do during that those two years?
I was a member of the management staff of Procter & Gamble Corporation in the Procter & Gamble Company in Cincinnati, which is the home office. And during the first year, I was an industrial engineer on staff there, working in the process area of food production. That means Crisco, Crisco oil, and other products that related to oils and shortenings. The second year, I moved into line management and was the foreman of the Crisco packing floor. And my brother, when he heard that, said, "Oh, so you're the guy who puts fat in the can." And that was my 2 years before I came back to graduate school at NC State in 1964.
It sounds like you met many people through your professional career. You know, you mentioned being in England or United Kingdom and the people at NC State. Who were the people that really influenced you or the people you learned a lot from in terms of doing simulation?
Well, first and foremost was Robert Lew Ellen. When I returned, Professor Lew Ellen, who was constantly learning new things, had been to MIT to take the course offered there in industrial dynamics. Pardon me, that's the forerunner of what we call today system dynamics. And he had offered a course in industrial dynamics and using a simulator that he had to develop because the machines, the mainframe computer at NC State would not support Dynamo, the language it was used at MIT. So he developed a Fortran simulator that we used to write industrial dynamics programs that represented models of manufacturing or larger corporation constructs that might tie together marketing, advertising, distribution, and manufacturing. And it was with Lew Ellen that I got the start on what led to my dissertation research. Now, I also...
Is this the master's or PhD you're talking about?
With Lew Ellen, it was the master's. But I used industrial dynamics in my dissertation research at Purdue a couple of years later. I also profited from the very active seminar series that the Department of Industrial Engineering conducted at the time, meeting such pioneers in the field, and it was eclectic. You might have Lillian Gilbreth, who is, as far as I'm concerned, the mother of industrial engineering. You might have Mark Cox, who was a probabilist from Cornell, and we had even had a representative, widely known representative of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. So they were providing students with an introduction to all, or let's say a very broad picture of the field.
Well, it sounds like that you got a master's from NC State and a PhD from Purdue, and you've been to United Kingdom looking at things. So why don't you, you must have done a lot of research. So why don't you tell us about some of your research, or let's research of major interest to you anyway?
Well, my initial research was in evaluating, using industrial dynamics models and modeling to evaluate control systems in libraries. And I used actually a field project because I used three different libraries with very different control structures at Purdue. Although I published work from it, I became concerned to some extent about the ability to validate the models in industrial dynamics. And I sort of went back in early research to a problem that stemmed from my master's research, and that was the problem of time flow mechanisms. And I did a work that it was published in 1971 in Management Science on time flow mechanisms for discrete system simulation. And what I think I showed in that paper was that the most common technique employed in the SimScript language and similar languages, which was called event scheduling, was not necessarily the most efficient execution technique for a simulation model. And that caused me to offer the idea that the internal structure, the relationship between time and state, was very determining of the actual method of time flow that would prove to be most efficient. And I produced experimental results to show that in some cases the fixed increment, where you use like a clock ticking off its seconds, was more efficient than the next imminent event determination that was common in many of the languages at the time, especially SimScript.
Well, you mentioned when you were in the United Kingdom, you looked at was interested in specification of models and model development environments. Could you please, that's an area that you apparently was interested. Could you mention any research you did in those areas, please?
Yes. While I retained interest in the time flow mechanisms work, in 1975 and 1976, two papers, reports actually, occurred from the federal government that were very critical of what they call computerized modeling, sponsored or contracted by federal government. I know you're familiar with those two. One came from the Office of Management and Budget, and the other came from the General Accounting Office. What the study had done is look at a number of projects and had made a determination that of these projects that were paid for with government funds, many were never delivered. A large number of those delivered were not accepted. And a large number of those accepted were never used. And the specific reason was the lack of understanding of the model. And it came through a lack of documentation of what was in the model. And the people at the government oversight level were not code readers. They were not coders. So I began to ask, how can we get a simulation model specification and documentation language or languages that would guarantee the documentation would make the model understandable because the documentation would be generated from the specification. And you had to have the specification to get to the code for implementation. So that led to my interest in what later became the term model development environments or simulation support environments. And that work was prominent in my mind when I went to the UK in 1980. And when I came out, it was very actively let's say I was very actively consulted by the Navy because of their difficulties with simulation models of naval combat systems. And so in 1983, we received the first significant research. We received a little on SMSDL, the Simulation Model Specification Documentation Languages, earlier, but we received the first large grant to work on model development environments. And that work I did prominently with Osman Balji, Dr. Balji at Virginia Tech, and with Dr. Mike Overstreet at the time at Old Dominion University.
Well, you mentioned discrete event simulation. They usually put randomness in that, so I think you may have done some work on random number generators, so could you maybe comment on that, please?
Yes, during that early period, I was intrigued by the ability of a deterministic machine to produce things that appear to be random. And it brings chuckles to me because I remember some of my early discussions with people. A name that is not widely known in simulation circles, but certainly in dynamic programming circles and operations research is Professor Eric DiNardo of Yale. And DiNardo made the comment to me at a conference we were attending that he considered random number generation computer witchcraft. I began then to try to look at the work that had been done and what we knew about random number generation. And luckily, a man far more knowledgeable and talented than I, Professor Donald Knuth of Stanford University, wrote a volume of his Art of Computer Programming series on random number generation. And that probably represented the state of the art at the time. I know that I couldn't work all the problems that he had in the volume two, semi-numerical algorithms, but I didn't know many people who tried. So I did do work in random number generation. I was very interested in how to deal with small word length machines because microprocessors were starting to come on the marketplace in the 75, 76, preceded somewhat by what we called middle level machines or workstations. And they did not necessarily have the same word length. And your dependency on the cycle of a random number generator, that is the period before it repeats values it's previously generated, is dependent on the word length. So I looked at techniques to try to extend the word length on small word length machines. And in so doing, I shouldn't say extend the word length, extend the period of the generator. And we were successful to a certain degree, at least in providing a factor of 12 in the increase in the cycle length. So that's the work that was during that period.
I think you also have done some modeling analysis of queuing systems, and they can also be used for operating systems and performance evaluation. Would you care to comment on some of that work, please?
My first appointment following the PhD was at the time was known as the Computer Sciences Center at Southern Methodist University. The Computer Sciences Center, for me, was an ideal location. It later became the Department of Computer Science and Operations Research. But the reason it was ideal is you had the interface of computer science and operations research emphasized there. You had people in operations research doing prominent research at the time, and those of us interested maybe in computational aspects of the operations research classical areas like linear programming and queuing theory provided a duality of approach to problem solving that didn't exist in too many places in the country. So I was fortunate to work with a very well-known applied probabilist and statistician, U. Narayan Bhatt. And Bott and I produced models of time-sharing operating systems in computers using a semi-Markov process approach. We had a paper in the Journal of ACM that was followed later by a paper that dealt with the inversion of the Laplace-Stieltjes transform that results from the semi-Markov process model. And we later followed up with a paper about 1979, as I recall, after I had left SMU and was at Virginia Tech, on a model of a multiprocessor operating system. And that work even, we came back to in a network study in the 90s that was published. So I never left it totally, just the distance between Dallas and Blacksburg was too great to keep it, always on the front burner.
I know you have a lot of interest in simulation programming languages, and I believe you wrote some papers on the history of simulation programming language. Would you please elaborate about that interesting work, please?
I was very interested in simulation programming languages. The very prominent RAND reports, series of RAND reports by Kvyat and Fishman, Kvyat's work did a classification of the programming languages, which was extremely helpful in understanding the difference. Kvyat also made a statement that I think is important now to recognize. He made the observation that the proper role of science and or theory and application is that the application should reflect the theoretical underpinnings. But in simulation programming and in the programming languages, there was almost a dichotomy among the practicers of simulation. There were the SimScript programmers, there were the Simula programmers, there were the GPSS programmers, maybe the GAS programs, and they didn't talk to each other as much as was needed. And it was like the application in terms of the language was driving the theory, but at the same time constraining the theory. So in part that was also motivational for my work in model development environments, because I was trying to get above the implementation level to look at conceptual modeling and then realize a good deal of the responsibilities. Now, in terms of the work in history of simulation programming languages, I was fortunate to be involved in the 1978 History of Programming Languages Conference. Gene Samet of IBM, Jan Lee of Virginia Tech, and a large programming committee held a conference where they selected the most influential languages between 1955 and 1978. And I was asked to be a commenter on the Simula programming language, which was, in addition to the GPSS programming language, presented at that conference. And the conference attracted a great deal of attention. The great names in computer science and simulation were there. We had some very interesting revelations of how languages and language development actually took place within both a technical and a political environment. And it had a great influence on me. And then in 1993, the History of Programming Languages 2 conference was held at Cambridge. Again, Gene Samet was involved, and I submitted a paper. You were, in some cases, the the program committee identified the languages that were to be covered in this conference, and they selected 8 languages that they felt had had the most influence on the development of computer science and software engineering since 1978. I had a submission that actually did a history of the genre simulation programming languages, and that was the only genre paper that was accepted. But I delivered that paper at Cambridge, and it was published in a book in 1996 that was ACM Press, I think in concert with Academic Press.
Thank you about discussing that with us. You mentioned software engineering. I believe you've done some work in software engineering. Please comment.
Well, you know, if you're going to work in model development environments, you're going to have to be concerned about the user and the interface between the tools you supply to the user. You're going to have to be concerned about how these tools are designed so that they can be supported, sustained, maintained. And I also was beginning to be influenced by my work with the Navy and seeing the importance of reliability and sustainability in the software that was being used. So I tried to move toward a better understanding of software engineering and where its roots really lay and where it was going. And if you can recall back in the late 1970s, 1980s, there was quite an argument about software engineering as a field, whether it really existed or whether it didn't, whether it was a graduate degree versus could be an undergraduate and graduate degree. So there was a great deal of turmoil about how software engineering should be viewed, particularly in the academic domain. Just as a sidebar, in 1980, when I was working with the Naval Surface Warfare Center on a sabbatical leave, that did not exist, a classification in the federal system for either software engineer or computer scientist. So when a government installation hired someone, they were either a mathematician or an engineer. And that was causing a great deal of difficulty. And I was helpful with a couple of people rather high up in the Navy to cause the eventual introduction of both software engineer and computer scientist in the GS, the government classification system.
Well, you described considerable amount of research work, and you mentioned your graduate work. So how were you supported in graduate school and for all this research work? There must be some organization. You mentioned Navy, but could you comment on the sponsorship of your work, please?
Well, the principal sponsor for me, I did have some National Science Foundation support when Bott and I began the work on the modeling of computer time-sharing systems. And we had a National Science Foundation grant. He was the principal investigator. I was just an investigator. So the prime sponsor was the Navy. And that began prior to 1979, 1980, when I stepped down as department head. But as department head, I was restricted in how much of my time could be spent in research, which is one of the reasons I decided I didn't want to be department head after 6 years. So in the 1980s, the Navy became a major supporter of the work in the model development environment area. They also became a major funder and sponsor of our work in software engineering. And we began to take on projects that I found very attractive because I got a much more definitive evaluation of the impact of our work from the Navy sponsor, who would say, okay, we're going to do this, or we think you haven't considered the problem to this level. And I like that because I liked solving problems or creating solutions that were used. And I didn't like the idea of producing something that's impact on the field was it set on a shelf in a library or in an office gathering dust.
How about graduate school? You got a master's, PhD. Do you have any support, financial support for that work?
I did, had very strong financial support, but I'm not sure of the source. It was a project through Purdue. Professor Ferdinand Leinkuhler was the PI, and I frankly just don't know. My suspicion is it came from the Department of Education, but I'm not sure.
Okay. I believe you wrote a book. Would you comment on the book you wrote, or co-authored?
I wrote a book with my co-author, Professor James D. Arthur, that represented the accumulative knowledge of a series of projects done for the Navy. And I was extremely still proud of that work. The book is entitled Managing Software Quality, the Objectives, Principles, Attributes Approach. And we were challenged by the Navy when they had to produce a single candidate for integration into a military-wide system. And they had two software development methodologies that were in use. And we were challenged to come up with a procedure to decide which is the better. Now, you've worked with military, I know. So you know how loaded this is politically. Because you're going to tell one group, you're not doing as good a job as the other group. And they've got to defend themselves. So we developed this approach. Basically, if I can just say, it relied on the idea that when you're developing software, you have objectives for that software, like reliability, like correctness, like sustainability, like portability. And these objectives can be achieved if your methodology enunciates several and enunciates well the several principles that are employed, and we connected which principles were important for which objectives. And if you use these principles, if your software development environment employs these principles, then you should see certain attributes in the product. So linkage between objectives to principles, principles to attributes, and then we defined indicators of the presence of the attributes in the products. Through an accumulation of the actual examination of code and documentation, we could develop a scoring mechanism that would measure from indicators identified in the code and documentation to the evidence of the attributes that you want to see, from the attributes which principles are being employed, and from which principles which objectives are likely to be achieved and to what degree. So that's why it was called the Objectives, Principles, and Attributes. And I think one of the most grueling examinations of my life was presenting the results of our study of these two Navy systems to a cadre of captains, Navy captains, from both systems that were, or methodologies that were being evaluated. And it was difficult because one methodology had scored higher on all objectives, on each objective, there were seven objectives, than the other. And there was a strong reluctance to believe this. And I was asked, well, you know, this is all subjective, isn't it? And I argued that, no, not totally subjective, because you have to have these indicators. You have to justify these indicators. And you have to, and through literature review, confirmation in other among other researchers, we established the relationship between the objectives and the principles and the attributes. That got a certain degree of positive response, but not much. But then I said, it could have been that system A would have been higher than system B, just because of the way it is. I said, well, let's look at it this way. Let's say that we've got seven objectives. The probability of system A being higher than system B on any one objective, if it was all random, would be 1/2. Right? Yeah. Well, what's the probability that system A would score higher than system B in all seven objectives? Well, that's 1/2 to the 7th power, a 1 over 128. So my argument is this is not just a subjective exercise here. It's consistently showing that one methodology is producing a better product in terms of accomplishing the objectives than the other.
Well, thank you. That sounds like a very thorough and interesting exercise you have writing a book as well as performing the research. Let us move on to another area that you've done considerable work in, and that's a service area. And so let us first discuss about your editorial work. So could you maybe do a little description, maybe over time, of what you've done in terms of editorial work with regard to simulation?
Yes, Bob, I think that would be something that that's notable in my career, the editorial work. I started with as a reviewer for Communications of ACM, for AIIE Transactions, for that's the American Institute of Industrial Engineers, for Operations Research, and I was asked because, and frankly, my boss, a fellow named Ron Gu at SMU, pushed forward my name to the editor of the AIIE Transactions, saying, this man does a very good job in reviewing papers. You know that because he sent you too. Ron, as you might expect, if he got a paper and is the director of the center, he didn't have time to review it, he might say, Dick, would you review this paper for me? So I was asked to become the simulation area editor for AIIE Transactions, and I held that position for about 4 years, I think, in the 70s. I moved from there. I was asked by a former colleague, Bill Priscala, when Professor Priscala moved to Northwestern, he was named the editor of operations research, and he asked me to establish an area of operations research that would include simulation, certainly, but they would also include perhaps a broader characterization of the interface between operations research and computer science. So I became area editor of an area that I titled Computational Structures and Techniques. And I served there getting a couple of interesting special issues by very strong names in simulation, such as Robert Sargent. And we began to, I think, have a very positive effect on the view of simulation within at least a part of the operations research community. And Professor Wilson has made the comment that simulation struggled to be a reputable approach to problem solving and a reputable research area in the 70s and 80s. So part of my motivation was to try to elevate the consideration of simulation within the research community in operations research and computer science. I also was helpful, worked with the establishment of the ORSA Journal on Computing. And the OR Journal on Computing was founded about 1975-76, I think. Am I wrong on those dates? I'm not sure of those dates. But it may have been later. I think it was, it may have been later. But the OR Journal on Computing, I served in an area for 4 years. And I felt that I had to give it up because I was named the editor-in-chief of the ACM Transactions on Modeling and Computer Simulation. And that occurred because we, the community, put forth a proposal to the Association for Computing Machinery to establish such a transactions. I chaired the committee that carried this forward from the Special Interest Group on Simulation to the ACM Publications Board. And I felt that as an editor-in-chief of ACM, TOMAX, as we called it, I did not have the time and did not want to have any perceptions of a conflict of interest by continuing to hold journal editorship responsibilities. So I then dedicated myself to TOMAX for the next 6 years, and I will have to admit that dedication has gone even longer than that. I still am involved with as a member of the editorial advisory committee for TOMAX.
So you're involved with a number of journals, and you apparently were on editorial boards, involved in many committees. You didn't mention those, but I know that you've been involved across. I think you're on the Journal of Simulation editorial board.
That's correct.
There, so you just touched on very briefly your tremendous work in that area of editorial thing. But
yeah,
I think the main thing is you kept bringing simulation into new journals, and that's, I think, a very important service.
Thank you, and I think it is too. I mean, I think that the perception of simulation as a reputable, in fact, important discipline within the field is important, and it was always kind of a contradiction. Workers in the research community had sort of a less than ideal, or certainly sometimes even less than positive, recognition of the research and practice of simulation. But when you went out, and some people did, and did a survey of what techniques were being used in the field, simulation would always be at the top of the heap. So the practice and the community that was applying problem-solving techniques recognized the importance and utility of simulation, but we needed to bring often our research perceptions, those performing research, to a level. I have to cite the work of George Fishman, Professor Fishman at Chapel Hill, Professor Don Eaglehart at Stanford, as individuals who were instrumental in accomplishing this change, improvement in the perception.
Okay, you've done considerable other service work. Could you talk about your work you did with ACM, Pacific Sig Sim, and also any other ACM groups you want to comment on?
Well, yes, I was fortunate at early on, a fellow who was a president of ACM named Walter Carlson recognized me for work I was doing as the chair of a special interest group on information retrieval, possibly, maybe something else. I don't know exactly what, but I got a call from him one night, and he asked me to take on a task on a committee within ACM, and I agreed to do so. And I then was, Walter Carlson was succeeded by Gene Samet as the president of ACM, and Gene asked me to accept appointment as chair of the External Activities Board. Now, this is just right after I had served a stint as the Special Interest Group on Information Retrieval chair, because information retrieval was of interest to me, continuing from my work with the libraries and looking at the expansion of libraries into more computer-supported information systems. I had a competitive motivation between IR, information retrieval, and simulation. But I became chair of the External Activities Board, which was the board that looked at all the external relationships of ACM. So it had some very important functions and very important committees performing these functions. The awards committee was part of the External Activities Board. The Public Policy and Information Committee was part of it. The Ethics, it wasn't called the Ethics Committee, but that's what it amounted to at the time. So ACM was really run by the SIG Board, the Special Interest Group Board, the Educational Board, the Publications Board, and the External Activities Board. And all four of these reported to the Vice President of ACM. So that responsibility was demanding during a time when I was a department head, a young department head, but it was also fulfilling. And I came into a contact with a lot of members, very well-respected members of the computer science community in performing my duties as chair of the External Activities Board. I became chair of SIG-SIM, interestingly, in the 1980s. And my plank in the platform was we need an ACM publication on simulation. And that was a plank that was not widely shared, evidently, although I was elected by the community, but it took a while. So luckily, I didn't end up viewing myself like Harold Stassen. And most people probably don't remember Harold Stassen, but he always was running for the GOP nomination and never succeeded. He was a boyhood wonder governor of Minnesota. In my successor, Professor Stephen D. Roberts of NC State, with his support and others within the SIG-SIM community, we did then get a strong endorsement of forming a committee to study the possibility of submitting a proposal to the ACM Publications Board to charter a new journal on simulation, as we described it. Now, I'm going to be honest. I think I was helped by my prior history as the External Activities Board chair, because I came into contact with people in the ACM headquarters as well as the ACM volunteer hierarchy, and that was helpful in getting a reaction that turned out to be positive when we came forth with the proposal to the Publications Board. And TOMAX was formed, was approved in 1989, was formed in 1990, and we began to accept papers, I think, in February of 1990.
You're also heavily involved doing service work to what used to be called TIMS and ORSA, which is now, of course, the Informs Society, and specifically there's Informs Simulation Society that resulted from the early organizations, but Could you comment on any work in for those groups?
Can we take a break at this point? Let me get a drink of water.
Again, and you can repeat the question.
Okay. I know you've been involved with the predecessor to what's called Informs today, namely TIMS and ORS, and now we have the Informs Simulation Society. But would you comment on the earlier work in those areas as well as the current work for Informs Simulation Society?
I think I served as vice president or vice chair, I'm not sure which.
Chair.
Vice chair of the TIMS College on Simulation and Gaming, as it was known at the time, and then chair in the early 70s. That was a very good experience, a very, let's say, fortuitous experience in that I became to get in contact more with the professionals in simulation, and it was a major determinant of my decision to really forego my research, continuing active research, for the most part, in information retrieval and deal specifically with and exclusively with simulation. Of course, later on, I moved and included software engineering. But the TIMS College on Simulation and Gaming was also very important in that it was a co-sponsor. It became a co-sponsor of the Winter Simulation Conference. So, around 1975, I was contacted by a fellow named Paul Roth from the National Bureau of Standards. And Paul Roth held a meeting, I believe it was at the Bureau of Standards. It involved people like yourself, Bob Sargent, and a number of others who were from organizations that wanted to see the Winter Simulation Conference continued. Unfortunately, the 1974 conference the books were never closed, and that caused organizations like ACM and IEEE to say, you can't use our sponsorship anymore because you haven't closed the books, which we require at every conference. So we began the people in this room and the meeting with Paul Roth began the task of, let's get our conference back on the route, back on the road. And a lot of people worked very hard, and we got a renewal of the conference held at the Bureau of Standards in 1976, the bicentennial Winter Simulation Conference. And I can remember my work. I published a paper there, which was very interesting. At the time, Mike Overstreet was my co-author, and we looked at the use of simulation programming languages, gathering our data through a survey of various academic institutions is what language do you use in your course or courses in simulation, and that's what we discussed. I served on several committees and on special issues in the operations research and TIMS. I guess the most I remember two foremost. One was being involved with the establishment of the, I guess it was called at the time, the College on Applied Probability within the Institute of Management Sciences. A group of us, Narayan Bhatt was very instrumental in that, and a number of others. And the other was the within ORSA and TIMS was the computer science section, I guess it was called, of ORSA. Professor Harvey Greenberg, who had been a colleague of mine at SMU, was the leader there, but a group of us met and prepared a proposal and got that led to the creation of that section. And of course, they both still exist today within INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research and Management Sciences, as the in the case of simulation, the INFORMS Simulation Society, some of us call it ISIM, and then it's still called the Applied Probability. I don't think it's called a section, though. What is the society, the Applied Probability Society within INFORMS?
So you also, I believe, served on some committees in the INFORMS Simulation Society. So after these two organizations merged, TIMS and ORSIP formed INFORMS, you continued to do your service work with us.
Yes, I did. I continued to do some committee assignments or I've been fortunate also to receive awards from the INFORMS Simulation Society, and as you mentioned, one of the ones that I value very highly is the Lifetime Professional Achievement Award.
You also provide a considerable service to the Winter Simulation Conference and the Winter Simulation Conference Foundation. You mentioned that you helped in the rebirth of the WSC in 76. You'd like to make any other comments of your work you did with the Winter Simulation Conference?
Well, I served on the board only from 1976 to 78, as I recall, which makes the stint of my service pale in comparison with others who have followed, sometimes serving for 8, 10, 12 years. So I can't ask for a lot of kudos in that regard. But the WSC, it quickly became the premier simulation conference, and there were a lot of competitors, but it became the premier international conference for publications and presentation of simulation research. And viewed as the place to network with your colleagues or those whom you wanted to meet and whose work you wanted to perhaps know on a more personal level. And I've never counted the number of papers given at the Winter Simulation Conference. But in 1989, I was asked to become the associate program chair, leading to being the program chair in 1990. And I like to think that the 1990 program was a little bit of a hallmark. It was the first program that had every paper reviewed. And that prior to that time, not every paper had been reviewed. The abstract might have been reviewed, but not the full paper. Well, there was full paper there. And Osmond Balgi did a fantastic job as the proceedings editor. He provided a list of all the participants in the conference and I think set some goals for the proceedings, which were adopted by succeeding conferences, and I think to the benefit of the WSC. But it is an institution that we valued highly within the profession. And when the recession of the 2000 timeframe, 2000-2001, came upon us, I was very happy to see a fellow named Jim Wilson come forth with a proposal to create basically a support fund in case we didn't get the anticipated turnout because of the recession's effect on the attendance at the conference. That fund that was created through hard work on Jim's part led to the formation of the WSC Foundation, and that foundation continues, and the WSC is on a firm foundational pardon the pun, the firm foundational basis because of the funds that are there within the foundation in the case of the need for a rainy day. The foundation has become even more active, though, in terms of actually supporting certain sessions and the formation of certain sessions at the Winter Simulation Conference. So it is just more than an insurance fund or insurance support. It is looking to extend and improve the services rendered to the profession by the conference.
I believe you're also on the committee that formed WSC Foundation. Is that correct?
Yes, I was a member of that committee. The committee was formed in order to lay the transition of a donation fund into a foundation, and my recollection is that I took the easy way out and became the structure was set up so you had a past chair, a chair, a new member, okay, and the
four members. A vice chair and a secretary treasurer.
Secretary treasurer, okay. So I chose, well, in fact, with help from an unnamed source who discovered that I probably was the earliest serving on the WSC board, I took that seniority to say, well, I'll be the past chair. So I really served only 1 year. But we did a lot of work in, actually I served 2 years, because we did a lot of work in forming the structure of the foundation and how it would operate and function. And I think the outcome has been just excellent for the profession.
Okay, you've done other service work. Would you care to comment on any of that? For example, I know you're involved with the Simulation Archive, but there may be others you may want to comment on.
Well, I would particularly like, because tied in with this oral history project, of course, is the Simulation Archive at NC State University. And the archive is intended to try to preserve important documents, artifacts of various kinds to characterize the history of simulation. And I really shouldn't use the term characterize as to really define it, and at least for the future. I have chaired and am currently chairing the Simulation Archive Advisory Committee. And this committee is advising the library staff who have done a superlative job of setting up the procedures, the mechanisms, the people to create and maintain this archive, which has donations from various simulation people, and will be taking those in the future from pioneers like those that we are interviewing in the Oral History Project. And the Oral History Project will be adding a significant addition, I think, to the archive in terms of the words, the words describing the history of simulation from the mouths of those who did it. And that's one of the big advantages of doing oral history. So
thank you for discussing your service work. I think we'll move on to another topic now. You received 2 degrees from North Carolina State University and also have been honored by them. Would you please comment on this?
Well, I am very honored to have been designated as one of the 12 outstanding alumni of the Edward P. Fitz Department of Industrial Engineering on the occasion of its 75th anniversary. It is with a good deal of humility that I came in and to accept this, and I did so or expressed this humility because it was a faculty designation. And when you're recognized by your peers as having accomplished something, that I think means a lot. My late mother was able to be here for that, and I recall one of the points that I made was, up until that point, the faculty member who sort of served as the informal historian had not invoked the name of Everett N. Case. And I'm sorry to divert a little bit from simulation, but Everett N. Case is the father of the Atlantic Coast Conference basketball. And he was a basketball coach at NC State from 1947 to about 1964, I think. He really did make the ACC exist and then make it a power conference in basketball.
I gather you have high interest in NC State basketball.
You could say that. I won't go any further that direction, though. I'll stay on target.
Well, let's Virginia Tech and NC State were playing each other in basketball. Who would you cheer for?
I don't cheer for anyone. I retain neutrality.
All right. Well, I think it's good to have a little outside interest shown because Dick has a lot. What is your favorite hobby?
Well, now, see, I'm afraid the IRS might see this and say, wait a minute, you tell us it's a business. So let me call it a hobby business. I like to restore old cars, primarily those from the 50s and 60s, although I do have one 1940 Ford that's one day not going to be just in pieces.
All right. Well, it's good to show that he has some breadth besides service and research. You co-authored the paper on simulation for the 50th anniversary of Operation Research, which discussed the history of simulation. Could you comment on how simulation has changed over your professional lifetime?
Wow. The interviewer, Robert Sargent, and I were asked to perform this task, and we put in a lot of sweat equity, I think, is as it's been called, to get this done. The early days of doing simulations were fraught with, if you drop the deck of cards, you're going to be in real trouble. So we used 80-column cards. We used the output from line printers, which you could tell usually the maker of the line printer, because IBM printers would be a very anchored line, very, very nice anchored line, much like a typewriter. CDC would be jumping, but then they never did. Never did typewriters either, so I guess we can forgive them for that. We went to things like paper tape. We had magnetic tapes. The kinds of machines that we worked on. My first programming task, which was not a simulation, was on an IBM 650 that I think had 2,000 words of memory. And the 650, we interacted with from afar. We actually did coding forms where we wrote out the cards to be punched. The cards were punched by key punch operators. We got them back. We checked them very closely because it was important not to waste the computer run, because you only got one a day, or maybe one every 2 days. And then we got these things to run, hopefully, and if we wanted to preserve them, we had something called magnetic tape readers and writers. And I can remember when I returned for graduate school in 1964, the IBM 1410 or an IBM 1620 were available to use. You could use the 1620 if you were a graduate student and had been checked out on the machine to generate programs. You actually had card decks to represent that the card decks were the something called a precompiler and a compiler, and then you put in your program, it generated a compile deck, an executable deck that you resubmitted to actually produce the program. And I was working on my master's thesis, and we found a solution in a generating function solution to the problem I was working on by a group of English authors. And I wrote a program to use the generating functions to produce the expected value of the machine efficiency, which was the primary statistic I was seeking. And the only problem was, in doing this on the 1620, I couldn't get all of the operations to get output in a 30-minute period, and that's all we were allocated. And it was so heavily used that the 30 minutes is what you could get. So I could never really validate the, I don't really consider it a validation. I'm not sure what I would be validating. I was cross-comparing an analytical solution with a simulation solution. I could never get that done. The 1410 was a very interesting machine. It was decimal arithmetic, variable word length. I went from there at Purdue to a 7094, which was like going to heaven, because a program that had taken an hour and 10 minutes on the 1410 would take 2 minutes on the 7094. 7094 was replaced, and in a succession of hardware and software advances, but primarily the hardware technology in terms of speed and memory, programs became so much more capable of supporting the human need. The difficulty is that the human need always expanded to consume all of the resources that the technology would provide. So that's the way the progression has gone. As the technology, either hardware or software, gives us more capability, our expectations or perceived needs always expand to fill up that and go beyond it. So is that a sufficient recap of the history in 4 minutes?
All right, so what do you see for the future of simulation?
Well, I would like to be able to recall a quote that we used in the 50th anniversary of operations research paper from a very eminent computer science pioneer. The first director of Project Mac, which was at MIT and developed the whole implementation of time sharing initially as a prototype, was Dr. J.C. R. Licklider. And Licklider wrote in a paper, and if you recall whether it was 67 or 70, I think it was 67, paper on dynamically executable languages. And that's what he called simulations. And he said that he was convinced, in looking at simulation, the area of simulation using digital computers, that its potential for the future would expand to be so important in the history of science that it would be compared with when man first learned to make marks in the sand to do computation. Now, that's a pretty lofty goal, a goal for the future, but I think that is a potential that is still being realized with simulations and with the field of simulation. And I'm just very glad to have been part of it. I guess I would like to think that maybe my editorial activities that were motivated by the desire to elevate simulation as a subdiscipline within the what I'll call the problem-solving disciplines of computer science and operations research, management sciences, decision sciences. I would like to think that that would be viewed, but maybe that's too that's too self-serving. And I am particularly proud of the work in the model development environment area, because I think I had an influence with others of pushing workers in simulation, modeling and simulation research to consider doing verification and validation at the conceptual level, and to view the verification process as extending from the early statement of the problem and how it existed in the minds of a modeler to its realization, perhaps through transitions of various forms that gave us the resolution of the abstraction that was inherent in the mind of the individual and the differences in how individuals perceived a solution to a problem. I always felt that if we waited to try to validate a simulation result in terms of looking at the results and the code, we were creating a lot of impedance to establishing the correctness of a model, or the accuracy, or the precision of a model. And that was because a lot of what is in, is particularly back in history, a lot of what was in the code was there because of the necessities of the execution process imposed by the machine and the software, the intervening software. It really, as I said, impedes understanding what the modeler is trying to create and produce in terms of its relationship to the system being modeled. So I think that our focus on, you know, that started perhaps with higher level programming languages and then environments for supporting model development, the interactive, even earlier, the interactive program generators, I would like to think that had a major effect on those people working in modeling methodology in particular.
What would you like to have people remember about you as a person?
I think it's how, well, he didn't shy away from controversy. I had my share of that. I always felt that honest statement of opinion, honest appraisal, being an charged with things like evaluating Navy software methodologies to decide. And frankly, we were selected at the Systems Research Center to do that because we were identified as the only honest brokers. Everybody else had an oar in the water somewhere between the two methodologies. So I guess, being asked to give a presentation on an evaluation of the high-level architecture, HLA, in which all of the key people in being funded by HLA is sitting there responding to your critique, I think personally would say, he followed the Latin, non illegitimum carborundum.
What advice would you give to a student entering the field of simulation today?
I think the most practical advice I would give would be, if the student isn't, let me take it as a graduate student, because I'm not sure as an undergraduate student it would be the same. An undergraduate student, give strong attention to your course or courses, and don't become preoccupied with programming games or playing games that really represent some very extensive simulation, but you can fall into the trap of being an addict in game playing. But a graduate student, I would give the very practical advice of select the right mentor. Select the faculty member whose demeanor and whose actions you would like to emulate, and get the right mentor, and then don't neglect becoming a member of at least one professional society. And because simulation is so multidisciplinary, perhaps more than one. And I would like to see more of a concern at an earlier level in the opportunities and advantages of being a member of a professional society.
Are there any other comments you'd like to make in this interview? As that ends my questions, but you may have something you'd like to comment on. If so, please do so.
No, I would like to thank you, and I would like to thank the staff at NC State University Libraries, and I would like to thank Jim Wilson, tell you this has been a very rewarding experience, and I appreciate all that is being done to support the Simulation Archive. And I should do that because I chair the advisory committee.
Well, thank you very much for spending your time with us today.
Thank you.